From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new film comedy, It Could Happen to You, co-stars Isaac Hayes. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Hayes about his music career. In the 60s, he helped create the sound of Memphis Soul as a songwriter, producer, arranger, and singer at Stax Records. He co-wrote Soul Man for Sam and Dave. Then he made hit albums of his own like Hot Buttered Soul and Black Moses. His theme for the film Shaft helped define the sound of the 70s. Also today, TV critic David Bianculli reports back from L.A., where one of the hottest topics among TV executives is TV themes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. House and Senate negotiators have finished work on a compromise crime bill. It would cost $32 billion. Some features include an expanded list of offenses that draw the death penalty and a ban on assault-style weapons. It also provides money for 100,000 local police officers. President Clinton says the crime bill is one of the reasons he ran for president. He calls it the toughest, largest, and smartest federal attack on crime in history. Baseball fans may have a disappointing season. Players have decided to go on strike unless owners agree to a new labor contract by August 12th. Laura Seidel of member station WNYC has this report.
Donald Fair, head of the union, says their officials believe that setting a date will maximize the chance of successfully negotiating an agreement without going on strike. Fair says the date is a way of forcing owners to focus on negotiations now rather than later in the season. Players fear owners will unilaterally impose a salary cap after the season unless there's an agreement to replace a four-year deal which expired on December 31st. The union hopes the threat of a strike will force owners to reach an agreement in order to preserve the postseason, an estimated $140 million in television money and an average of $5 million per club. If there is a strike, it will be the eighth work stoppage for players in 22 years. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Seidel in New York.
A Washington state wildfire has more than doubled in size today to 54,000 acres. The huge blaze is burning near Lake Sheelan's southeast shore. Local officials say it threatens hundreds of vacation homes. More than 1,500 firefighters are on the scene, but the fire is now too big and too intense to contain. It's already destroyed 13 homes and dozens of buildings. The United Nations commander of Bosnian peacekeepers was rebuffed when he tried to meet with the Bosnian Serbs today. Lieutenant General Michael Rose wanted to confront the Serbian leadership over their attack on a UN convoy yesterday. One British soldier was killed, another was wounded. French soldiers who rushed in to help were also attacked. Secretary of State Warren is warning the Serbs they face the possibility of new NATO airstrikes if they continue their attacks.
I think they may have, just in the last few days, sought to send a message to the other parties here that they still have great power. So I would say that we need to have a stricter enforcement of the existing exclusion zones, and that will require perhaps a further use of NATO air power. Now, NATO is ready.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher speaking to the House Foreign Affairs Committee. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 9 points at 3,729. Trading is heavy. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq Composite Index has fallen almost a point to 714. This is NPR. Gunmen in Russia have taken over a bus and its passengers. They're demanding millions of dollars in ransom and a helicopter to escape in. It's the fourth such kidnapping this year. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
This time, Russian authorities say four unknown gunmen took some 40 passengers hostage in the southern Russian town of Pyatigorsk. They then drove the bus to the nearby resort city of Mineralny Vody, where they are demanding the helicopter and $15 million in cash. Mineralny Vody is the site of the three earlier similar episodes. In each case, the gunmen have come from the nearby Caucasus Mountains. In each case, they have been paid the ransom, fled by helicopter to either the rebel Mountain Republic of Chechnya or to the Dagestan region on the Caspian Sea. And in each case, police have arrested the gunmen and recovered most, but apparently not all, of the money. This region of southern Russia is composed of a patchwork of so-called autonomous republics, each dominated by a different ethnic group, many of which have aggressively resisted control from Moscow. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
The number of Rwandan refugee camps in Zaire has grown. Relief officials opened 4 new camps today. They want to ease crowding at 4 existing camps and stop the spread of fatal diseases. More than 1 million Rwandans have been crammed into the camps around the border town of Goma. They've died at the rate of more than 1,800 a day, mainly from diseases spread by bad sanitation and filthy water. A U.S. Army water purification unit still can't deliver the clean water it's producing. There are no trucks to pass it out. General Motors Corporation says it earned almost $2 billion in the second quarter of this year. That's more than double its profit for the same period a year ago. It's the most profitable quarter ever for the world's biggest automaker. The release of GM's results confirms each of the big 3 U.S. automakers set company profit records in the quarter. Ford and Chrysler have already reported their profits. Ford garnered $1.7 billion. Chrysler made $956 million. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. That's the action theme that launched a new sound in action themes. It's the theme from Shaft, and it won a 1972 Academy Award for the composer and singer Isaac Hayes. He went on to star in a couple of action films. More recently, he was featured in Keenan Ivory Wayans' black action satire, I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker, in Mel Brooks' Robin Hood, and Mario Van Peebles' Posse. He co-stars in the new comedy, It Could Happen to You, which opens tomorrow. In the 60s, Isaac Hayes helped shape the sound of Memphis soul music as a songwriter, arranger, producer, and singer for Stax Records. He co-wrote hits for Sam and Dave, Carla Thomas, and Johnny Taylor. Then he started making his own albums like Hot Buttered Soul and Black Moses. Before we hear some more of the music he wrote, let's listen to his 1970 recording of Jerry Butler's I Stand Accused.
I stand accused of loving you too much, and I hope it's not a crime, 'cause if it is, I'm guilty. Loving you, oh yeah.
Well, Isaac Hayes, I'd love to do a little musical biography of you. I know when you were growing up, your idol was Nat Cole. What did you love about him?
I loved his voice. I loved his delivery. He was so smooth and so cool, and his selection of songs, you know, mainly the romantic stuff. And I just loved it.
Did you ever try to sing in his style?
Yes, I did. When I was in high school, I won my first talent contest. I sang Looking Back. And after then, they called me Nat on the campus. I was a freshman in high school, and everybody called me Nat. I mean, I was signing autographs and all that stuff, and just really, I guess that's when I realized I wanted to be in music.
Now, I know before you started making your own records, before you started singing in your records, you produced for other people, and also you played piano and keyboards. You used to play with Booker T and the MGs. Now, how did you learn to play piano? Growing up as poor as you did, I know there were times in your life when you didn't have shoes, let alone a piano.
That's true. How did I do that? Well, let's see. A friend of mine I grew up with, Sidney Kirk, used to be my accompanist. We went places and he'd play for me. He joined the Air Force. He wasn't there. There was a call into him about a gig New Year's Eve. His sister knew that I was destitute and I needed money, so she asked me if I wanted to play. Well, I could play maybe chopsticks and stuff like that. And I said, yeah, I'll take it. I took the gig out of desperation. And when I got to the club, I was petrified. I said, oh, my God, they're going to shoot me. I can't play. And musicians started coming in, you know, setting up, tuning up, and I'm sitting there, you know, trying to be cool. I said, God, they're going to find me out. And the featured artist came in and said, hey, man, do y'all know such and such? This is the first time this band had been put together. We didn't rehearse anything. And everybody said, yeah, we know it, blah, blah, blah. So he kicked off the tune, and it sounded horrible. Everybody did. I said, wow, these guys can't play either, so I'm comfortable. And, you know, being New Year's Eve, the clientele was drunk, and they thought we were cooking, you know. So, and somewhere along the line, the club owner, he was sauced. He came up and said, you know, you boys sound real good. Y'all want a regular job? Yeah, we'll take it. And that was in Memphis, and it was a regular gig. And each night I would learn something more and more on keyboards. And that's how I got started.
That's great. And then you started sitting in with Booker T and the MGs.
Well, I wound up at Stax Records. I changed bands, and I joined Floyd Newman's band, who was a staff musician at Stax. He played baritone saxophone. All those bot-ups and stuff like that, that was Floyd. So he was up for recording. He said, man, you know, we're going in the studio. And I had been, prior, I had been to Stax about three different times with the blues band, with a vocal group, you know, trying to get a break, and it was always turned down.
Mm-hmm.
This time went in with Floyd and Howard Grimes, a drummer. He and I wrote some songs and instrumentals and things like that. And Jim Stewart, who, you know, was on a cone of Stax, he said, you know, you sound pretty good on keyboards. Booker T is off in Indiana U in school. Would you like to become a staff musician here? Yeah, you know. So that's how I got in Stax. And my first session, I think, was an Otis Redding album session. I was scared to death. But he made it easy. And I learned a lot, and I fit right in. And I became a staff musician. So when Booker came back, he and I both played on sessions. We would switch around. Sometimes I'd play organ, and he'd play piano. And sometimes I'd play piano, he'd play organ. And with Duck, Steve, and Al, we were the nucleus of Stax, the rhythm section, and then, of course, the horns and so forth.
Now, you were not only a house musician at Stax, you became a house songwriter, and you wrote a lot of songs with your partner then, David Porter. And some of the most famous songs that you wrote were for Sam and Dave, like Soul Man and Hold On, I'm Coming. How were you given them to write for?
Well, first thing, David, when I started at Stax on staff, David and I went to rival schools, sang in rival groups. And he said, hey, man, I write lyrics and you play music. Let's hook up and write like Holland Doja Holland. I said, okay. So we teamed up and we started writing. And one day, Jim Stewart called us all, everybody on staff, said, we got some fellas coming down and they need some writers and producers. So they're going to come around and meet with everybody and you show them what you got. So when Sam and Dave and them came to town, they, you know, met with everybody, and they wanted to work with David and me. And that's how the whole thing started.
What do you remember about writing Soul Man?
Well, I remember getting the idea from watching TV and the riots in Detroit. And it was said that if you put soul on your door, your business establishment, they would bypass it and wouldn't burn it. And then the word soul, you know, the clenched fist, you know, soul brother, soul this. It was a galvanizing kind of thing as far as, you know, African Americans were concerned. And it had that kind of effect of unity. And they said it with a lot of pride. So I said, well, why not write a tune called Soul Man? And all you had to do was write about your own personal experiences. Because, you know, all African Americans in this country, during those times especially, had similar experiences. So we did that. But realized that it, in addition to being an African American experience, it was a human experience. So therefore, it crossed the board. And then the groove and all everything else that went with it just made it, you know, very, very commercial.
So did you arrange this too?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And are you featured instrumentally?
I wasn't featured. I just played piano on it. Well, you know, I did some little hot licks in there and stuff like that. So,
okay. Well, let's hear Soul Man, co-written by my guest, Isaac Hayes. Isaac Hayes is my guest, and he's co-starring now in the new film, It Could Happen to You. So how come it took several years for you to actually record your own vocals?
Well, remember I told you about Nat Cole's story, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I started singing in high school. I sang before Nat Cole, when I sang Looking Back, that was in the ninth grade. But before ninth grade, preteen, I used to sing, but I sound like somebody in the boys, Vienna Boys Choir. My voice was way up there like that. And they would call me, oh, man, you're a sissy. So when I reached puberty, my voice started cracking and squeaking. And then when it cleared up, it was down in the basement. So I started singing again, and I was singing jazz. During my teenage years, I was singing jazz in a local nightclub. I was singing with a blues band. I was singing with a rock and roll group called the Teen Tones. I was singing with a gospel group called the Morning Stars. We had a little combo, and during my senior year, we played. So I had all this experience, and I would go to Jim Stewart and say, hey, Jim, I want to record. I want to try something. Well, like, you know, we are R&B label, and your voice is too good. It's too good for what we're doing here. So I never did get the shot until one day. It was someone's birthday party at Stax, and we always served champagne and cake. And we had gobbled down some cake, and Doug Dunn and I grabbed a couple of bottles of champagne and ran into the ladies' restroom and closed the door. And we just guzzled this champagne down. I mean, I got a buzz. Came out, Al Bell, who at that time was the head of national promotion. He wound up being executive vice president, but he said, Ike, I want to cut something on you. Okay, yeah, I don't care. I was feeling no pain. So we go in the studio, Al Jackson on drums, Duck on bass, and myself at piano. And I said, man, y'all follow me. It was all impromptu. And we stayed in the studio a few hours, and we finished. I said, okay, I got what I want. And that was that wound up being Presenting Isaac Hayes, my very first album.
My guest is songwriter, singer, and actor Isaac Hayes. He co-stars with Nicolas Cage and Bridget Fonda in the new film It Could Happen to You. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Isaac Hayes. You developed a style of singing in which you did long raps that kind of gave a backstory to the song, and the rap would lead you into the song. And the songs are often, you know, like pop tunes other people had written, like By the Time I Get to Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd kind of make up the whole story leading up to it. How did you start doing that, combining these raps with pop tunes?
Remember the famous quote in Cool Hand Luke? I forget the actor's name. What we have here is a failure to communicate.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Sure.
Well, I did that. The rap came out of the necessity to communicate. And the way it happened was, is a local club in Memphis, predominantly black, that was called a Tiki Club. And, you know, we would hang out there. The barcades were playing there sometimes. So we'd hang out there and sit in. You know how musicians do. And this one day I heard this song by Glenn Campbell, By the Time I Get to Phoenix. I said, wow, oh, that song is great. I mean, this man must really have loved this woman. And so I ran down the studio later on that day and said, man, y'all hear this song, Phoenix? Man, it's great. Everybody, yeah, you know, no enthusiasm. I'm saying, these guys don't feel what I feel. What, are they getting it? So the Barcades were scheduled to play the Tiki Club a couple of days later, and I said, hey, man, I'm coming down and sit in with you guys. Learn By the Time I Get to Phoenix. They said, okay. I told him the key in E flat. And so I went down, and the club was packed. Go up on stage. Ladies and gentlemen, you know, y'all know him, blah, 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 Isaac Hayes. And there's all kind of conversations going, you know, blah, 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 blah. I said, oh, man, how am I going to get these people's attention? So I said, hey, man, the first chord in the song, y'all hang up on it. It's a B flat 11. Just hang up on the chord. Just keep cycling it. And I started talking. I just started telling this story, how it was a scenario, how about what could have happened to cause this man to leave, you know. And I started talking, and the conversations halfway through the rap, that conversation started to subside. And when I reached the first line in the song, when I said, by the time I get to finish, everybody went, wow. And, you know, when I finished the song, it wasn't a dry in the house.
Well, I want to play an excerpt of your recording of By the Time I Get to Phoenix. This is Isaac Hayes.
But one day, old boy got sick, and he had to come home. I don't have to tell you what he found. Oh, it hurt him so bad. He said, baby, mama, why? That's all he could say. But she said, oh, gone, fool, you doing it. But the man wasn't doing it, but that's the only excuse she could give him. He said, mama, I can't take it. I got to leave you. I'm going to leave you. Well, she tried to straighten up. She said she was going to straighten up. She got a little job to help him out with the bills, too. But that was just a sham. Because he found it again and again. And seven times he left this woman. And seven times he came back. And he had taken all that he could stand. And the eighth time that this went down, he said, Mom, I got to go. He said, I'm leaving my heart right here. By the time I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising.
Isaac Hayes, do you feel a kind of special affinity with rap music now? Do you see do you feel a connection between what you were doing and what's being done now?
Well, some people try to equate it. In the sense that it's rap. Now, the only way I came close to this rap is the first verse in the song Shaft, and that is, who's a black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? Well, that's rhythm. That's rapping in rhythm, and that's what this rap is today. I think that's the only similarity that I might have with the rap of today. Everything else, it differs. You know, I never considered myself a rapper. They say, you know, although I label the tunes Ike's Rap 1, Ike's Rap 2, and so forth. But I more looked at myself as a storyteller,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Shaft, because that's the next stop on on this tour of your work. Now, you recorded the theme for the movie Shaft in, I guess it was 1971. How were you asked to do this?
Well, it was a whole concept. Hollywood recognized that they had to look further than they had been looking to get business. I think it was fledgling at the time. It was a bit stagnant. And Melvin Van Peebles had put out a movie called Sweetback's Badass Song. And they said, it might be a market there. If we come up with a concept to have a leading man, a black director, maybe a black composer, we might hit that market. MGM was the one that pioneered the idea. So we had a meeting out there at MGM with Stax execs, and they asked me to come. And they talked about the concept. And would I do the music? Would I be interested in doing the music? Yeah. I said, I want to act too, man. Have y'all cast for the lead role? Well, I don't know. We'll look into that. But anyway, I think that was a sticking carrot, you know. So,
right.
So I agreed to do the music. They had already cast Richard Roundtree, which was rightfully so. He's perfect for the part. And I agreed to do the music, and that's how that whole thing, that whole idea came about.
Here's where you really get into orchestrating, right?
Mm-hmm.
So tell me how you started using that wah-wah guitar funk style.
Ha-ha. Well, okay, trade secrets. What happened was, I had been doing arranging all the time. I did a lot of arranging with the horns and stuff at Stax, and the first string arrangements I tried was a thing that Dave and I did on Sam and Dave. And that album was like a big flop. But we tried it anyway, but I had a taste for it, and once I tasted the strings, I couldn't let it go. Now, when sometimes in the studio you're working on various grooves and stuff and you can't find a name for it or you can't tag it with anything, you just, if it feels good, you say, okay, I'm going to file that. And you put it up. You put it back and you store it. Now, when it was time for me to do the Shaft theme, I said, now, what can I do? They explained the character to me, you know, a relentless character, always on the move, always on the prowl. And you got to get something to denote that for the main theme. I said, what can I do? I thought about, if you remember Otis Redding's Try a Little Tenderness, I had a hand in that arrangement too. In the end, Al Jackson was doing some stuff on a hi-hat cymbal. You know, you got to na-na-na, boom, you know. So I thought about that. I said, maybe if I just sustain that particular thing on the hi-hat, that would give you a dramatic effect as something that's relentless. Now, what else can I do? I thought about the guitar lick, and I went and pulled it out, played it, and Charles Pitts, we call him Skip, he played the thing on the wah-wah. I said, hey, play this line. And he started it. And I told Willie, the drummer, I said, Willie Hall, I said, give me that hi-hat, man, some 16 notes, you know. And he did that, and it worked. I said, that's the kind of dramatic effect I want. Then I started putting the other things in, you know, the bass, the accents and all that stuff. But that's how that whole wah-wah thing came about.
Well, why don't I play some of your theme from Shaft, a classic. This is Isaac Hayes.
Who's the black private dick? That's a sex machine to all the chicks. You're damn right. Who is the man that would risk his neck for his brother, man? Can you dig it? The cat that won't cop out when there's danger all about.
Shaft.
Right on. You see, this cat Shaft is a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
What I'm talking about, Shaft?
Well, we can do it.
He's a complicated man, but no one understands him but his woman.
John Shaft.
Isaac Hayes co-stars in the new film It Could Happen to You. He'll be back with us in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. What clothes looked best on a 70s soul man and action hero? Coming up in part two of our conversation with Isaac Hayes, we talk about his image on and off stage. Hayes co-stars in the new movie comedy, It Could Happen to You. And TV critic David Bianculli considers the sticking power of TV theme music. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. House and Senate conferees have finally concluded work on a compromise crime bill. The legislation includes new money to hire 100,000 local police officers. It also bans 19 types of semi-automatic weapons. President Clinton delivered a speech today at the Justice Department. He praised the lawmakers for ending 6 years of wrangling over the crime bill.
They are reaching for a new consensus that reflects the world we are living in, and that recognizes the absolutely horrendous conditions in which a lot of our younger people are living, and the need to be very, very firm, but very, very smart about the road ahead, its difficulties, and its challenges.
The legislation will now return to the House and Senate for final approval. The former White House counsel is denying he ever interfered with a Whitewater probe. Bernard Nussbaum told the House Banking Committee today neither he nor anyone else in the Clinton administration tried to influence federal regulators who were checking into a failed Arkansas savings and loan. The failed Madison Guarantee savings had ties to the president and Mrs. Clinton's Whitewater land deal. The former presidential aide says the meetings he had with regulators were proper. Nussbaum acknowledged that in general such meetings should not occur, but he says there's no ban against it. The Coast Guard is expected to board a burned-out fish processing ship today. It exploded and burned in the Bering Sea earlier this week. The fire killed one crew member and forced 132 others to abandon ship. Paula Dobbin at member station KTOO in Juneau has this report.
The Coast Guard's Pacific Strike Team is making a first survey of the ship's interior to assess the damage and determine whether it's safe for salvage crews to go on board. Later, the Coast Guard and the National Transportation Safety Board will conduct separate investigations to determine what caused flames to break out in the ship's cargo hold on Sunday. The 340-foot fish processing vessel has been moored in Dutch Harbor in the Aleutian Islands. The Coast Guard says no flames or smoke are visible, so it appears that the ship is cooling off. After the All-Alaskan caught fire, an 8-mile oil sheen was observed, but the Coast Guard says the spill has dissipated and no other pollution is evident. For National Public Radio, I'm Paula Dobbin in Juneau.
Liberal Senate Democrats met with First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton today to discuss a timetable on health care. They're planning to try and amend Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell's plan, which will take a slower approach toward implementing universal coverage. Mitchell is expected to call for covering 95% of Americans by 2000 or 2001. Senate Democrats say they don't want to move that slowly. On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 10 points to end at 3,730.83. This is NPR. France's prime minister, who is currently touring West Africa, says he will make a surprise visit on Sunday to Zaire, where he will visit the refugee camps. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Prime Minister Edouard Balladur made the announcement during a speech to the Senegalese parliament, which was broadcast on French radio. He said he wanted to pay tribute to the 2,500 French troops who are part of the intervention force and also visit refugee camps. He'll be the first Western leader to tour the camps, where almost 2,000 people are dying each day. Balladur said the French intervention had succeeded in making other countries aware of the seriousness of the crisis and that finally they were joining in the relief effort. Balladur does not plan to go into Rwanda itself, where French soldiers are starting to withdraw. A military official said all French troops will be out of Rwanda by the end of next month. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Israel is vowing to find those responsible for a wave of attacks on Jewish targets in Latin America and Great Britain. Israel's cabinet is condemning the violence and calling on other governments to take effective action against terrorism. Security is being beefed up outside Israeli embassies, consulates, and Jewish centers worldwide. Diplomats based abroad are being told to take extra care. A car bomb exploded last week in Buenos Aires, Argentina, outside a Jewish community center. At least 95 people were killed. The next day, an airplane exploded in Panama, killing 22, 12 of whom were Jewish. 19 people were hurt this week by two car bombs in London. One was outside the Israeli embassy. The United Nations commander in Bosnia isn't accepting Serbian apologies for yesterday's ambush on a UN convoy. Lieutenant General Sir Michael Rowe says the Bosnian Serb excuse of their mistake is worthless. He says the Serbian attack was deliberate. One British soldier died. French keepers who rushed in to help were also attacked. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Isaac Hayes. He co-stars with Nicolas Cage and Bridget Fonda in the new movie comedy It Could Happen to You, which opens tomorrow. In the first part of our interview, we talked about his work as a songwriter, producer, and singer at the Memphis soul label Stax Records. And he told us about composing and singing the theme for the film Shaft. Let's pick up where we left off. Now, there's something I've been hoping to be able to play for you for a long time, and I'm just thrilled I have the opportunity to do it now. I want to play this record for you, and tell me, I figure you've probably heard it, and you could tell me what you think of it. So let's hear an excerpt, and then we'll talk about it.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? Can you dig it? Who's the cat that won't cop out when there's danger all about? Right on. Black private eye, whose mastermind has got him what he wanted. Shaft. Shaft is the man.
Isaac Hayes, you recognize the recording?
Yeah. I produced that on Sammy Davis.
Did you really? You produced it? That's Sammy Davis. Yeah. No, what did you think of Sammy Davis doing Shaft?
Well, I mean, I was thrilled. You know, I mean, you know, Sam and I were friends, and he wanted to do it. You know, and in fact, the night that we were in the studio doing that, it was the Golden Globe Awards. And I had no idea I would win, so Lou Gossett received the award in my stead. And I was in the studio with Sammy. Oh, wow.
It just seemed, you know, it's just really funny it's so out of character for him. I mean, he was going through this real kind of groovy period, I guess.
Yeah. You know Sammy, you know, he was into what was happening now, which is good. You know, he rolled with the trends.
And then years later came I'm Gonna Get You Sucker, Keenan Ivory Wayans, loving satire of all the blaxploitation films, which of course you co-starred in. It's a wonderful film. You must have really enjoyed that.
Oh, man, we laughed throughout that film. I mean, we blew so many takes because it was hard to keep a straight face, you know?
Now, you know, at the time that Shaft and Superfly were really popular, I mean, everybody now, all the black filmmakers now, just credit those films with paving the way to all the new work that's happening now. But at the time, the NAACP was appalled at the black action films. And I wonder what your reaction was then to their reaction.
Well, you know, I had mixed emotions about that. That position was that, you know, it was painting a bad image, you know, for the kids and so forth, and there were no alternatives. Had there been some alternatives at that time, then I don't think the NAACP would have come down so hard. But what happened was, when they did that, it was like it turned off the tap. It totally dried up for us because Hollywood said, whoops, hands off. And they dropped everything, and our whole little thing just died. I think, you know, in hindsight, had there been a little more patience at the time, maybe it could have taken off in some other directions, because it was in its embryonic stage at that time, you know, the black cinema. Mm-hmm. And anything in its infancy, you're gonna get a lot of crap. You're gonna get some inferior things and all of that, and the quality and so forth, and even questionable subject matters. But as that particular genre grows, then, you know, you start getting better films and so forth. And I think they might have made the move a little bit too soon, because when we were doing these things, we weren't taking ourselves seriously, not as the characters. We were just glad to get the work, glad to get the experience, glad that our people could see us on screen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and...
And as leading men.
Yeah. You know, and not with a broom and a mop and bowing and say, yes, sir, boss.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so that's why it took off and it was so widely received. And I think had a little time to go, a little longer, you know, you split off in some other areas and Hollywood would have recognized that there is more that could sell than, you know, the pimps and the hookers and, you know, the private eyes and so forth.
Composer, singer, and actor Isaac Hayes is my guest. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Isaac Hayes. I want to spend a couple of minutes talking with you about how you developed your image. When did you start shaving your head?
I started shaving my head not long after I got out of high school.
It wasn't fashionable then.
No, it wasn't.
To my knowledge. What inspired you to do it?
Well, you know, during those times as musicians, it was a fad. We had a relaxer in our hair, called it a conk process. And during that time, mine was cut very low and just slicked down on my head all the way around like a coconut, you know. And it was hip. It was a style. But in the summertime, it was hard to keep up. And you sweat and it come undone and... You had to sleep with a stocking cap on, all that kind of stuff. I said, I'm sick of fooling with this stuff. I'm going to cut it off. So I went to the barbershop around the corner from Stacks. I said, Mr. King, cut it all off. What? Cut it all off. I'm going to grow a new crop. And when he cut it off, you know, I went outside, you know, and I said, wow, it's a breeze out here. It feels great. I can feel the wind on my head. Hey, I think I'll keep it like this. I already had the beard. And people would look at me and say, oh, wow, oh, look at this guy, man. He's got baldy in the beard. But I didn't care because it was different. I like being different. You know, I like swimming upstream. And a funny thing, one time, Booker T, by some error, had somebody book two dates on the same day for Booker T and MGs. And one date was in, I think Booker had to go to Oklahoma somewhere. And I went to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania with Al, Duck, and Steve. And David Porter was a vocalist. And I was to pretend to be Booker T. And I'm at the organ. We kicked off the tune, kicked off Green Onions, you know, and grooving. Somebody said, hey, man, ain't no Booker T. He ain't got no hair. And, I mean, they were ready to riot. I jumped up from the organ and got out there with David, started dancing and singing and doing everything, trying to appease the people, you know. But finally, they said, well, okay, what the hell, we'll accept him. And, I mean, I played the entire gig. And, of course, years later, I went back as Isaac Hayes, and I played Harrisburg, and I told that incident, and some people remembered it, and they cracked up.
That's funny.
But, I mean, I was an unknown, but I just looked different. I liked a different look.
Are you still doing it?
Oh, yeah. You see, the thing about it is, it's ageless. So when I go naturally, no one will know.
Now, how did you start wearing gold and velvet and furs?
Well, you mean just day-to-day or...
Well, I don't know what you wore day-to-day, but I know you certainly wore that on stage.
Oh, now, on stage, I wore... Okay, French rabbit boots. I wore tights of different colors. And I wore chains. Now... And I'd come out with a cape and a floppy hat. Why did I do that? Okay, a sense for the dramatics, okay? You see, at first I would wear, during the days of the hippies, I'd wear a lot of rawhide with fringes and beads and stuff and moccasins and bell bottoms. And it was hot. It was hot. And later on, I thought, I said, when I see entertainers perform, they come out with three-piece suits on, with ties, and the first thing they do is loosen the tie and throw the jacket off. And then they might take the vest off. I said, well, I'm going to go out there already comfortable, so what can I do? So I start wearing the vest and the tights. Tights are comfortable. Ballet dancers wear tights, so why can't I? And a guy gave me a chain necklace and a belt, and I tried that on stage. And when I came out like that, women were screaming. You know, I was always taking mental notes of effects and so forth. And I said, maybe I'll do this. And I started doing it, and somebody suggested, why don't you put a robe on, because you want to go out there and give it to them all at one time. Put a robe, put a cape on, and then throw it off when you get out there. I tried that effect. Wow. And then I put a floppy hat on and showed my head later, because I remember one time I went out on stage and I had a hat on, and it started sweating. I took it off to wipe my head, and women screamed. Okay, I'll use that too. And then this guy named Charles Rubin said, Isaac, I have an idea. I'm going to make you some chain vests. I said, okay, try that and we'll see. And he made them, and it worked, and that's how it came.
I'm thinking of how very different your stage image was from the kind of elegance and sophistication of your idol, Nat Cole.
Quite a bit, let's say radically different, right?
I guess it was a reflection in part on how you had changed or how the times had changed.
Maybe the times had changed. But I just like, I was a renegade. I had a renegade mentality. I always liked to be different.
Did you dress like that in private?
No. No, I mean, I dress real fly. If you remember in Gorelnik's book, he described I had a purple suit on with some purple shoes and so whatever it was, stand outside of stacks, remember? So I always dressed flamboyantly. I mean, you know, always flashy. I would dare to wear things that nobody else would try to wear. I had a girl to make me some Nehru suits and stuff like that back when nobody was wearing them. I saw the Pink Panther, and I liked the way... I like the way that, remember the first one where Capuchin, her chaperone, this guy was always around, tall, slim guy, had these Nehru collars and stuff on. I like that look. So I had a girl to make a lot of those things for me.
So this must have been real different from when you were growing up and you virtually had no clothes. You had no shoes. And
hey, you could put me out in the cornfield, I'd scare the crows away. You know, you know, when you're like that, when you grow up in poverty and you think about that meal you're going to have, you'd never be hungry again, Scarlett O'Hara. You think about the clothes you're going to wear. You think about the house you want to live in. You think about the cars, you know. So when you start acquiring affluence, money, you buy these things and you enjoy it. And I worked all of my childhood. I didn't have a normal childhood, you know, like growing up, because I had to become a man in the family at an early age, so I didn't have a lot of chance to do the play things that kids do. So when you grow up and have the money, these things become toys, and it becomes fun to you.
If you don't mind my saying, I really love your speaking voice, too, and you have really nice enunciation. Did you always talk with that kind of enunciation? Did you do that as a kid, or is that something you learned as a performer?
I think it's something that I acquired as I traveled. No, growing up in the South, man, you know, you don't sound like this. Mm-hmm. No. I don't know what I sound like then, but it wasn't like I am now. But, you know, growing up and going all over the world and different places and interacting with people, you kind of take on this thing. People don't know where I'm from.
Right.
You know? And I like that.
Now, we have to let you go in a second, but are you recording again in the near future?
I just signed a deal with Virgin Records a couple of months ago, and I will be recording. I'm going to do a Christmas song. I mentioned that Christmas song to mm-hmm. you. I'll be doing two Christmas songs coming out in December, and then the album, my regular album, will be forthcoming probably the first quarter of next year. And so it's things really happening. I got films coming. As you know, we mentioned, It Could Happen to You is a wonderful film. I recommend it. Everybody go see it. It makes you feel good. It tugs at your heartstrings, and you know, it makes macho guys get misty-eyed. And I just finished a film in Wilmington, North Carolina, with Tim Reed directing, called When We Were Colored. Beautiful film. Spans a time between around 1951 and 64. So it's a lot of things are happening, and I'm excited.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, Terry, it's been my pleasure.
Isaac Hayes co-stars in the new film It Could Happen to You. It opens tomorrow.
If you see me walking down the street and I start to cry each time we meet, and walk on by, walk on by, make believe that you don't see the tears. So just let me breathe in private, 'cause each time I see you, I just can't help myself. I think about how tight we used to be. I break down and cry. Oh, baby, walk on by.
This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. House and Senate negotiators now have a compromise crime bill worked up, including a ban on 19 kinds of assault weapons. Mary Kay Magstad has been to a town in Rwanda, and she's talked there with some of the refugees who've come back from Zaire. Jim Zaroli has the baseball strike story from New York. Major League Baseball players will go on strike the 12th of August. Mara Liasson reports on the Whitewater hearings from Capitol Hill. Also, some Whitewater satire from the reduced Shakespeare Company, letters from listeners about Rwanda and real Mexican food, and Andre Cadrescu, more on his trip to France.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. TV critic David Bianculli has just returned from the semi-annual Los Angeles press tour, where the makers and programmers of TV meet with the critics to promote new shows and discuss hot topics. O.J. Simpson and attempted network mergers were two big topics, but no subject caught fire more quickly than one involving a seemingly innocuous subject, TV theme songs.
Come and listen to my story about a man named Jed.
Actually, I want you to come and listen to a story about a man named Ted. Ted Harbert, the president of ABC Entertainment. Last week in L.A., Harbert admitted to critics that he was asking the producers of new series to do away with opening theme songs. He's also encouraging the producers of returning shows to do the same thing, even though the makers of Roseanne and Home Improvement already have flat-out refused. Why in the world would Harbert wage a one-man campaign to kill opening themes? Here's a direct quote. "I now think it's an antiquated practice," he said. "It gives the audience an opportunity to take the little remote and zap around." Is Harbert nuts? Doesn't he realize the value of theme songs? Most kids memorize them and sing along. Later, when you're an adult, they're an instant flashback to your childhood, like oldies radio. And even as an adult, new theme songs can give you pleasure. Like when you hear the drum beats on NYPD Blue and know another good hour of TV is just about to start. I'll bet you could play Name That Tune with TV themes as easily as you could with other forms of popular music and identify a lot of songs in just a few notes. In fact, to prove my point, let's do just that. See how many of these 10 TV shows you can name before I do. Ready? And away we go. The Addams Family. Bonanza. Hill Street Blues.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a
Gilligan's Island. The Andy Griffith Show. Monty Python's Flying Circus. Miami Vice. Twin Peaks. The Simpsons. Okay, so the last one was a gimme. But even if you don't watch much TV, I'll bet you could identify more than half of those songs. And if you are a regular TV viewer, you may have gotten a perfect score. Now, Harbert argues that most of the theme songs we remember are from a long time ago. And he challenged the critics to name some good new theme songs. So I did. I told him I liked the themes to NYPD Blue and The Simpsons and Dream On and Northern Exposure and Picket Fences. Besides, I asked Harbert, just because he was afraid of audiences changing channels during the opening credits, wasn't he robbing a future generation of theme songs? And he replied, if that ends up being my big sin out of all this, I guess I'll just have to live with that transgression against society. Since then, though, this issue has exploded in ABC's face. Executives at rival networks and the producers and stars of just about every new and returning series on the press tour thought it was a bad idea. This is one time, I think, when public opinion really can have an impact on television. Critics hate the idea, and viewers probably will too. If ABC is so worried about people changing channels, it ought to be more concerned about making better programs. But ABC may consider that a mission impossible.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Sue Spolin, Jewel Bracey, and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Mark Tullis. Abby Beshkin is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.